You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Lleida.
Where are we, Daniel?
We're in Lleida, or Lérida, as it's done in Spanish. Lleida being the Catalan name. We're in a square. We're in the Plaza de San Juan, I think.
Lleida.
Oh, good to hear the pronunciation police again there, but not maybe necessary, because I think you did that was pretty good, Daniel. You're good at this, these languages things, aren't you? Can you speak Catalan?
No.
None at all.
I understand a bit. Italians, I'm not Italian, but I speak Italian, Catalans tend to understand each other.
Well, Sardinia, was it not an extension of Catalonia, at some point? There was talk of the tour of Catalonia going to Sardinia.
Well, it was supposed to start there this year, I think. The Volta a Catalunya was supposed to start in Sardinia as a sort of offshoot of the Grande Partenza of the Giro last year. Didn't happen. But it has been there. The Volta a Catalunya has been Sardinia before. I think Sean Kelly won a stage there.
That's right. I knew that. So we are in Catalunya now, yet another region inching our way towards Andorra.
Amazing, Rich. Last night, we were when we finished the stage in at the Balcón de Biscaya, we were overlooking the Atlantic, in effect, the Bay of Biscay. And today, we were seeing signs for Barcelona, Tarragona, all places on the Mediterranean.
And we stayed in, well, near Pamplona last night as well. So, yeah, we're really mixing it up these last few days at the Tour of Spain. Before we get on to the tail of the etapa, some transfer news, Daniel. Larry Warbass has signed for AG2R, and you know, you put this on Twitter without crediting the source.
Well, what do you want?
Which was the Cycling Podcast.
It had been rumored. What do you want? Royalties?
I mean, you know,
every time.
It's bad enough. It's bad enough that the Bradley Wiggins podcast is stealing our ideas without you, a member of the team, not giving us credit for. Rumors.
I think
it's the only transfer rumor I've ever got right.
I can't listen to a podcast that I'm actually on, Rich.
Well,
I was sitting opposite you when I said it.
You were actually present.
Okay.
Anyway, tale of the etapa today. Stage that we didn't expect an awful lot from, but it was it was very exciting in the end. A breakaway, not a big breakaway, a very small breakaway. Yelly Wallies.
Yelly Wallies.
Sven-Erik Bistrom, the UAE rider, and Jetsy Ball, the Dutch rider on the Burgos BH team. They got away very early on. Two World Tour riders, one Pro Continental rider, but, you know, a strong break, but never had more than 2.5 minutes. It was a tailwind that certainly played in their favour. And in the end, the peloton just misjudged it. They shed Jetsy Ball. He lost contact 7 kilometres to go. But the two World Tour riders were very strong, and held on, and Wallies won the stage. And what was quite nice about that was that Wallies had a terrible time at the Vuelta last year.
It's 8 o'clock. You hear that?
Yeah, it's
the
8
bells.
O'clock.
Anyway.
Yeah. He had a terrible time at the Vuelta last year. Crashes. He was last man overall for a while. He was in a, you know, it was touch and go whether he'd make it to Madrid. And in fact, Fran Reyes talks in his chapter in the Cycling Podcast book about witnessing a top of a climb while he's being hit by a car door and being in real pain. And he said in his press conference that when he went for checks after the Vuelta last year, he had 2 broken ribs. Something else was broken. I can't remember now what it was, but he was in quite a bad way.
What's the beef with Quickstep?
Well, that's an interesting one, Daniel, because at the finish, Quickstep were pretty annoyed because obviously this was a stage perfectly suited for Elie Viviani. And when Viviani came back to the bus, he's normally very, you know, friendly and open and accessible, but he was clearly pretty annoyed. And as Wallies went past the bus on his way back to the podium, he kind of paused and gave an almighty roar, celebration, punching there, directed at Quickstep.
Well, not only that, Rich, but I don't know if you've seen Velon have released a video of the sort of minute or so preceding that, and he's saying, where's the Quickstep bus? Where's the Quickstep bus?
Yeah. What happened was, early in the stage, once he got away, Rick Van Slyke. Sleek? How do you pronounce his name? Sleek?
Slyke.
Slyke. Rick Van Slyke.
You have to imagine you're Patrick Lefebvre.
Yeah, Rick Van Slyke. I don't know how this happened, but I asked Walleyes about this in the press conference, what the beef was, because there clearly was beef. And he said that early in the stage, Rick Van Slyke pulled alongside him in the car and basically took the mickey. What are you doing? What are you playing at? And I thought to myself, I'll show you. And he described a game that they played. And he said the Peloton play a game with the breakaway. We've talked about this a bit this week about how, the Peloton decides, the Peloton is in charge. Well, I said that they really, really throttled back, you know, for most of the stage, and really only started riding hard in the last 40 kilometers. So they were almost lulling the Peloton in a false sense of, you know, these guys have been out there all day working hard. When we start chasing them, we'll be able to bring them back. They'd saved their strength, really, for the final hour, where they obviously did a big three-up initially, then a two-up time trial.
All meaning that Rick didn't look very slick at the end, did he?
Not very slick, not very slick. What's interesting about that is they are the two top Belgian teams, obviously, and I'm never that aware of a massive rivalry or you know, not like the Peter Posse, Jan Raas, Dutch team days. Marc Saint-Jean is a very affable, avuncular guy. And Lefebvre, you don't get the sense that it means an awful lot to them to beat Lotto Soudal. But there was an interesting little moment in the recent film, Running with Wolves, the film behind the scenes with Quickstep team at the Tour de France, where someone talks on the bus, someone makes a comment on the bus about the Quickstep bus about on a lot of Soudal will no doubt try to control things and chase down the break, and there's much guffawing, much laughter at this, as if this is completely unheard of. And I guess, you know, Quickstep, and we saw this a lot of the Tour, the responsibility falls on them an awful lot to set things up for a sprint. And lots of Soudal, even when they've got an Andre Greipel or somebody, and they'll have Caleb Ewan next year, don't tend to take that responsibility. But then, as we saw today, you know, they have a different collection of riders, and they often try quite different things. We were talking the other day about the Route 1, the long ball. You know, they do send guys out, whether it be Tim Wellens or today Yelly Walleyes.
Well, I think that there have undoubtedly been moments in the past 15 or 20 years when there has been tension. Marc Saint-Jean used to work for Patrick Lefebvre at Domo, I think when it was called Domo Farm Fritz. He was a director sportif there, and their paths diverged. Also, let's not forget that the company that used to sponsor what is now Lotto Soudal, Omega Pharma, moved over, in effect, to Patrick Lefebvre's stable. So, I think they get on pretty well, Saint-Jean and Lefebvre, but there is a perception which maybe takes away slightly from the rivalry. There's a perception that Quickstep are Goliath and Lotto Soudal are David. But in spite of the fact that, you know, as we've often said, Quickstep aren't as well funded as I think some people imagine. But yeah, it's a rivalry that you feel could spark to life again, intermittently.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor, and we'll be presenting a third and final Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt this week. The poll will open very soon. I think Michael Woods is a strong favourite for that, although he has won it before. But
we've had a pedaleur sans charme, a pedaleur without charme.
Have you got anyone in mind, Daniel? Sounds like
well,
you do.
Well, Richard, remember we talked about Michal Kwiatkowski a few days ago and about how he wasn't particularly relishing doing interviews on this Tour de France. Vuelta a España. It's been a long season. Enric Mas is not full of the joys of early autumn when he's asked to do an interview in the mix zone, I must say. Slightly just disappointing.
It is disappointing, isn't it? Especially for a 23-year-old who's never been in this position before, for him to already show signs of weariness and
lassitude. Yes,
that's disappointing. The final today, in the final, just to, you know, Belgian winner, so I'll speak Belgian. Wallis was a bit, well, he was certainly influenced by Paris Tours a few years ago when he was in a similar situation with Thomas Vogler. And in fact, he'd said that he basically, that was the blueprint he used today. Vogler knew exactly how to ride it that day and how to play with the bunch in the way that they did today. But he took a leaf out of Tommy Vogler's book in the finale as well, I think.
Yeah, he did, Rich. Just watching it, you couldn't quite believe that Bistrom Bistrom didn't simply slam on the brakes and demand that he came through, because I think from about 1.5 kilometres to go, he didn't take any turns. Bistrom, in fact, was very sporting, not only in the way that he continued to pull and ensure the brake did stay away, but also in his reaction off the finish line. There were no recriminations in Wallace's direction. He said that Wallace had pulled very hard in the last 10 kilometres and indeed throughout the day. So no issues as far as he was concerned. Bistrom,
bit of a beast.
Quite surprisingly, he hasn't taken it. I think I'm right in saying he hasn't taken an individual pro win yet. This is a guy who in 2014 won the under-23 Worlds in Ponferrada. And by all accounts, it's got a very big engine. Of course, it's not been a great 24 hours for 36 hours for the UAE team. Oh, it's all happening here. Money flying everywhere. We saw yesterday Fabio Aru come off on the descent before the final climb to the Balcon de Biscaya. And we also heard him cursing quite loudly in Italian about his bike. And there have been a few recriminations over the past 24 hours following that. Ernesto Colnago has been interviewed by some Italian journalists. Ernesto Colnago, of course, the very long-standing, well, the owner of his eponymous and very famous bike company. And he's 86 years old now. He said he was very upset watching Aru decry how poor his Colnago was. I mean, I'm not entirely sure that that's what Aru was saying yesterday. I mean, the words he used were basically this shitty bike. Could have been the frame, could have been the gears, and in fact he apparently had a gear problem. But Colnago certainly didn't appreciate it, and he said that when Aru called to apologize last night, he reminded him of his responsibility as a professional.
Yeah, not great publicity. It reminds me a bit of Tom Dumoulin and his giant bike earlier this year. That's not what companies put millions of pounds into professional bike teams for, is it? But so you don't often hear the truth about bikes unless, as we heard recently, the AquaBlue Sport team folds, and then you hear the gory truth. But yeah, it's an interesting one. That, yeah, I mean, Bistrom, yeah, he's not done what you would have thought he would do, and you know, he's not, as you say, he's not had a win, but he's not had many notable results. You know, another of these really strong riders, clearly, that's his best result as a professional. He's 26 now as well, so he's not that young anymore.
Rich, if I can go on a little bit of a tangent.
Sure.
Talking of Italian riders and outbursts, I had a bit of a chat with Giovanni Lombardi, who's the manager of Gianni Moscon, this morning at the start.
And Peter Sagan.
And I asked Giovanni what he made of Moscon's interview with the cycling podcast own Ciro Squagliamiglio in La Gazzetta dello Sport. If you missed, I think we discussed it in the podcast last night.
No, we didn't.
It was fairly unguarded.
Unapologetic
for what had happened in the Tour de France. Of course, he got kicked out of the Tour de France for allegedly throwing a punch at
Elie Gisbert.
Correct. And of course, Moscon has some previous, there was the incident, the racist insults towards Kevin Reiser a couple of years ago, and
just last year, in fact.
Being disqualified. Was it just last year?
Just last year.
And being disqualified from the World Championships for holding onto a car. But yeah, in the interview with Ciro, he said that it was unjust, the decision to chuck him out of the Tour de France, that he hadn't touched Gisbert. Basically, he said he wasn't going to change. He said that he was disappointed In the way that Sky seems to have hung him out to dry a little bit after the Tour de France, although he sort of understood when they were under so much pressure over the Chris Froome saga, the Salbutamol saga. But it was quite remarkable for how open and candid it was. And I expected to see Giovanni, his manager, in a bit of a cold sweat this morning, reaching for the Alka-Seltzer. But in fact, he said that, like it or lump it, that is Moscow on, and any attempt to change him in the near future is going to be doomed to fail. I mean, I'm quite interested in the dynamics. I haven't asked Cheer on how that interview came about and whether to what extent it had the blessing of Team Sky, because it certainly didn't do Moscow on any favours at a time when
Stefan Kung had punched him in a race.
Yeah,
you know. And so things like that, you know, are not going to endear him to his fellow professionals either.
No, and sort of speaking with Giovanni, I mean, this comes back to something we were talking about a few days ago with regard to Nasser Bouhanni. And a listener in our press conference episode challenged me on my sort of sympathy for Bouhanni. And I see a lot of parallels between Bouhanni and Moscon. Both, if you are sort of inclined to, you know, like authenticity, like people to show authenticity, like people not to filter what they say, then those two characters might quite appeal to you. You know, they don't sort of sugarcoat anything their personality, yeah, or in what they say. In that regard, I think they're quite similar. And Lombardi, as I say, Gianni Moscon's manager, sort of, he's kind of resigned to the fact that Moscon is always going to be like that.
But I said in the press conference that the line that Moscon crossed with the racist abuse at Kevin Reza is not something that people are going to or should forgive him for, especially when he has shown no contrition about that.
No, there's a kind of cultural difference, I would say, in the way that whole story was received and covered in Italy versus how it was covered and received in the English-speaking media. But Moscon is being paid a lot of money by an English-speaking team, and their main concern is the English-speaking media. So if he doesn't have any sensibility, any sort of sensitivity of that or towards that, then he needs to develop it if he's going to stay at Team Sky, because otherwise there are going to be a lot of situations where he gives interviews and he says that, or he thinks that what he said is perfectly fine, and then he goes back to the team and their communications team says, well, no, actually, yeah, that's,
and before we go before on. We go back to today's stage, a little detail from the story was that Moscon was at the Tour de France party, the Team Sky, you know, celebratory party, and you think, well, that's not really appropriate. He was sent home from the Tour in disgrace. You know, he was subsequently banned from racing for 5 weeks. It's not appropriate that he should be be part of the celebrations at the party in Paris. That again, it's just the tone. It's the tone deafness of that, knowing that would probably emerge at some point, that I don't get at all. So on the one hand, Sky hanging him out to dry, he says, but on the other hand, putting an arm around him and saying, you know, it's going to be okay, I think that'll not play too well with some people. But can we return to today's stage?
Okay.
Because I did speak to a couple of disappointed people at the finish. Michael Morkov, who is part of Elia Viviani's lead-out train, and Lucas Postelberger, who is part of Peter Sagan's lead-out train. And Sagan, I mean, he had a really good go to get back. Not a conventional sprint at all, but he launched himself in the final kilometer. And he was the guy, you know, like a heat-seeking missile up the finishing straight.
Remind me a bit of Mark Cavendish versus Heinrich Hausten in the 2009 Milan-San Remo.
Yeah, or Brieve in 2012 with Leon Sanchez, where a sprinter, and Sagan is more than a sprinter, but they've seen the race slipping away from them, and they've taken pretty drastic and action and used their initiative. And it almost, I thought Sagan was going to get them, and that would have been a quite remarkable performance from him. He didn't. But I spoke to, Michael Morkov. We'll hear from him first, and then we'll hear from Lucas Postelberger. Was that a case of two very strong riders being out there, or was it a case of the peloton not quite judging things correctly?
No, they were definitely strong. We started to chase them. We chased them the whole day. We kept them on a short time limit. But with 50 k's to go, we started to speed up, and they did as well, and we could see that we was not really taking any time off them, so it's just proved that it's super dangerous with a breakaway on a day like today with a tailwind.
Also, the team has a rider going for the podium. Does that affect how much you can put into setting up a sprint for Viviani today as well?
Obviously, we are keeping an eye on Henrik on the overall third place, but today we was going all for the sprint for Ilya, and we worked hard with Kasper and Peter, but unfortunately, it was not enough.
Quite an unusual outcome today. We don't see that very often. Was that a case of a tailwind, two very strong riders? What happened?
Yeah, it was a mixture of all, I think. The tailwind was really strong today. We estimated, to be honest, like crosswind in the final or crosstail. So we were ready, but the wind wasn't that strong, but strong enough to help the breakaway guys to survive.
And a case of two very strong riders, obviously, in the end.
That's true, yeah. With Pistrem and Valais. They're really good and really strong, have a big engine, all both. And, you know, we should work together all day long, so the chance is always there, you know, because especially in the tailwind, you're limited also with the gearings, going full gas in the descent.
At what point in the stage did you realize it might not be possible to catch them?
1K to go.
1K to go.
Yeah.
And then we saw Peter Sagan improvise a little bit. He did a bit of a Lucas Postelberger there at the Giro.
He went
very early.
We were expecting, to be honest, like a real lead out from Quickstep, but it was a big mess in the last roundabout. So they lost each other. Also, we lost each other. And then, like, it was Schwarzi. He did a huge turn till, I think, 900 to go. And then in the slightly descent to the 1K, we tried, but... We ran out of men, and he was, luckily he was on my wheel and I started to pull, but I think it was close. If we start 2 or 5 seconds earlier, but you never know. It was headwind in the finishing straight. This was also not the best. So, yeah, bad luck, but this is cycling.
That was Michael Morkov and then Lucas Postelberger. And before we say cheerio to Daniel and welcome Fran Reyes, we're going to talk a bit about the next couple of stages, which we'll talk about with Fran as well. But Daniel, you've always got things to say about mountains. How well do you know the mountains?
Not very well. I know I've been reading today about the theme park at the top of the mountain tomorrow, Naturlandia. And my position on Andorra is quite similar to Lionel's. I'm not a big fan. However, having read about Naturlandia and its 800 hectares of forests and, you know, adventure playground and the world's longest toboggan run, I'm starting to think I've got Andorra all wrong. You might not see me tomorrow, Rich. I might not be at the finish.
Tobogganing.
I might be tobogganing. I might be hanging from trees. I might be, riding wild horses through the forest.
It's also got one of the largest natural spas in Andorra.
Naturlandia?
No. What's the main...
La Vella.
La Vella, yeah. The big glass building. That's an 18-story spa. If you fancy that, if that's your thing. I don't know. Anyway, what can we expect from the stages?
It's a tricky one. The stage looks quite straightforward. It reminds me a bit of the stage where Simon Yates started to lose time in the Giro to Prato Nevoso, which it was broadly... Well, that was much flatter, actually. It was very flat and then a big climb at the end. Tomorrow, it's a gradual climb all day up to the bottom of Naturlandia, or the climb. And stages like that, efforts like that, tend to suit guys, tend to suit natural time trialists. It's going to be a half hour, 40 minute effort. Does it suit Valverde more than Simon Yates? I mean, I think Simon Yates will be slightly concerned about the finale yesterday and the ease with which Valverde gained those few seconds. You know, if Valverde did that again on either of the two stages we've got remaining, gained 10 seconds in time plus a bonus, that could be it. Or 15 seconds in time plus a bonus, that could be curtains for Yates. And I think that's a big concern, because it's something that's very difficult to legislate for. We know that at that point in the race, Yates is probably not going to have any teammates with him, however well Adam Yates rides. However, I'm really struggling with these Yates brothers tonight. However well Jack Yates rides, Jack Haig. On the other hand, what Simon Yates can cling to is the fact that Alejandro Valverde has not really put together a complete set of performances in Grand Tour mountain stages for a very long time. There's always been a day when he struggled, and you could argue that these two remaining stages in Andorra are the only real mountain stages of this Vuelta, because what we've had so far have been a lot of 15-minute efforts, 20-minute efforts, quite particular climbs, quite unusual climbs, very, very steep. And also there's the fatigue factor, and that is you could argue, where Valverde has come a cropper throughout his career. He's only won one Grand Tour, and he is consistently folded on the longest climbs and in the third week.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get your discount, can't you? Of how much, Fran?
25%.
We're using the code?
SISCP25.
At the website?
scienceinsport.com.
Brilliant. You've memorized this stuff. It's brilliant. Excellent. Just shows you what you can learn over 3 weeks, doesn't it?
Exactly. I mean, in 3 weeks, I've managed to learn three things. That's great. I mean, that's a great average.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Fran, I've been joined by Fran Race. You might have guessed that. Daniel's slipped away into the night, as he does. Fran, we were going to look back and forward. Look back on yesterday's stage and forward to tomorrow's in Andorra. But first of all, you wanted to talk a little bit about the other team that was represented in that breakaway with the Dutchman, Jetse Bol.
Yeah, Burgos BH, one of the biggest, most special oddities in Spanish cycling. You know, this team has been running for almost three decades already. First as an amateur team, one of the most successful in the Spanish scene, then as a continental team for almost 12 years, and finally as a professional team this year. How they manage? Well, thanks to Julián de Izquierdo, its manager, which is basically a magician when it turns to lure politicians into investing in his team, and is also Spanish Gianni Savio when it comes to at a dozen of sponsors every year that pay for the salary of a rider, and that way the team almost runs itself for free. But yeah, it's talking seriously and about things that won't get me sued, it's a very old-fashioned team that has been going on for a long time and has given the chance to become a pro to a lot of now established riders, such as Lluís Mas from Caja Rural, Sergio Pardilla, currently racing for Caja Rural, and whom you will remember from spells with Movistar Team and Dimension Data, Oscar Puyol, famously ran for Tervelo Test Team and now has turned into a presenter for Global Cycling Network, the Spanish version of GCN.
If only Jetse Bol could have held on to the two others, then it might have been a different outcome, but that was proved a little bit beyond him, and the world tour kind of strength told in the end.
Yeah, I mean, he said that he had some pain on his ribs, but what I gather is that he was just sprayed all over the road in a roundabout when he couldn't hold the pace of the other two guys, which are clearly stronger rulers.
Very, very strong. Two of the strongest rulers in the world, I would suspect. Now, Fran, I mentioned yesterday a very emotional win for Michael Woods, an outpouring of support for him to be crowned Pedlar de Charme this week, third week of the Vuelta. He actually was a Pedlar de Charme last year. Not that that disqualifies him, and I'm sure he'll be a very strong contender when we announce our shortlist tomorrow. But I went and spoke to him at the start. We talked last night about the, you know, very emotional interview that he gave afterwards. Dedicated the win to his stillborn son Hunter, and you know, after a night of, I'm sure, raising a glass of champagne celebration and reflecting on a win that's been a long time coming for him, I went and spoke to him this morning. Michael, that this sport takes you on a roller coaster of emotions if you follow it, and you certainly took a lot of people on that quite extreme version of that roller coaster yesterday.
Yeah, I think a roller coaster is pretty accurate. Maybe even not the best analogy, just because a roller coaster has a lot of highs. Far fewer lows in this sport than there are highs. If you have a 1% victory rate in this sport, you're a successful rider. This year has been really difficult, not just with my wife and I losing our son, but also with my wife losing her father a month before that. So it's just been a really tough year for us, and I wanted to get a nice result for her and for me.
It was a very powerful interview that you gave after. It was very moving. Was it a plan? Were you intending to? Because in mentioning your son, you sort of paid a tribute to him in a way. Was that something that you thought about consciously, or was it just something that came out in the moment?
It definitely came out more in the moment, but what really inspired it was on the final climb. I obviously have been thinking, I think about him every day, having held him, and you know, I've been so excited to bring him into this world. On the final climb, Juanma, my director, just kept on saying, do it for your family, do it for your family. And Juanma has been involved in my career since I started as a pro cyclist. He was my personal director right when I joined this team. And so he knows, he was well aware of all the tough times we've had in the last few months. And him saying that just brought a flood of emotions and really did make me focus on what we'd gone through in those final few hundred meters. And despite the fact I was really suffering, I was able to keep the momentum going. And it was just a release of emotion when I finished.
It was amazing to watch the final kilometer again, and obviously you were going through a million agonies, and it was a really extreme climb. You had somebody chasing you, but to watch it again, knowing what you'd said after the race had finished, was again very powerful.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it was also one of the reasons why I was going so deep is because I didn't expect it to be that long of a finish. We couldn't see anything just because of the fog and the fans. The fans were incredible. So I didn't know how long I had left. I thought I had only 200-300 meters left, and that's another reason why I was all over the road in the last few meters. But yeah, being able to just channel that energy, it was something I'll never forget.
I spoke to Simon Clark after the finish, and he said, you know, how you and he had spoken about it, and how he obviously had an important role to play, but there was pressure on you because it was a finish that suited you. You're still quite new to the sport, so you've not been in that position too often where you've had a chance to win a stage like that. What was going through your mind on the approach to the climb? Were you nervous thinking about that?
Definitely nervous. I've been in the position a couple times now, and I've been like the dog that catches the squirrel for the first time. I just didn't know what to do, like in those previous moments. And so I really tried to draw on them a lot in this final climb. Just tried to stay cool, tried to stay as relaxed and composed as possible. And then with Simon riding so well, I mean, that was a bit of added pressure because he was selling out so hard for me, but also it's so motivating. I had no choice but to succeed on that climb because of the attacks he was doing in order to set me up. Incredible ride.
For someone who didn't know the climb, you judged it perfectly. I mean, a lot of guys spent their bullets a little bit earlier on, and every attack you kind of followed it. You seemed to be riding quite carefully, cautiously, as conservative as you can on a steep climb like that, but you did seem to get it just right.
Yeah, well, I think, again, drawing on those experiences where I failed, where I came second or third or got complacent, I was nervous going on that climb because I knew I had the best legs. But if you're in that scenario, it's so easy to mess it up because you get too excited. And I just kept the whole time, my directors on the radio were saying this, but also myself just saying, repeating in my head, stay cool, stay relaxed, don't go too early.
So that was Michael Woods, and Simon Clark, his teammate, of course, in last night's podcast, told us that he thought that we'd have a sort of another Ben King scenario where once Michael Woods had that one victory, more would follow. And as we said there, the next two stages are ones that potentially could suit him. But we are looking forward now to the two crunch days in the Vuelta, aren't we? The two Andorran stages. Tomorrow's Fridays is it reminds me a bit like a Mont Ventoux style stage where it's pretty flat or rolling before a big climb up to the finish. And that's a particular kind of test. As Daniel has pointed out, it's not dissimilar to Prato Nervoso, the stage at the Giro d'Italia that caught out Simon Yates, or at least showed a first sign of vulnerability there. Then Saturday's a relentless all day of a full day of climbing up and down, up and down. So what are your these stages of these climbs that you know well, Fran?
Well, the first thing that springs to my mind when I think of Andorra's mountains are the fact that weekend in the Vuelta a España, I think it was 2002, where we had three straight mountaintop finishes in a row, and all of them came to disappointing outcomes where pretty much all the favorites reached the finish line together and only one escapee might be up the road, down the road, but nothing else. And with La Rabassa was one of those mountaintop finishes, and I am afraid that tomorrow we will see probably a similar scenario. Of course, there is this shock that always come after a whole day in the big ring, then changing into the small ring suddenly because the first kilometers of the climb are the steeper ones. But as for the rest, the road is more or less comfortable and the slopes are gentle. So it will take a very full-on attack, a very strong attack from one of the favorites, maybe Miguel Angel Lopez, who showed he excels in these kind of climbs, to actually create some meaningful gaps.
One thing we've spoken about a bit is, who at this point is going to be happy with their overall position. Some suggestions that Stephen Kruijswijk might be happy with, he sits fifth overall at the moment. I don't know. I think there's the possibility of a first ever podium in a Grand Tour for him. But who of the guys below Simon Yates is going to be happy to finish in the position that they're in? I'm guessing Valverde, if he's here and challenging for when wants to win the race, doesn't he?
I read this interesting point from a great Spanish Twitter, Fontania, Javier Amado, great insight also always about the developments of any race. He pointed the fact that other than the two Movistar guys, Nairo Quintana and Alejandro Valverde, none of the current men in the current top 10 of the Vuelta GZ has ever won a Grand Tour. So all of them should be eager to get the victory. In the case of Alejandro Valverde, I would say that another Vuelta podium doesn't add anything at all to his career, so he for sure should be aiming for victory. Movistar team, they desperately need a GT victory, hence this lineup where most of the Tour de France domestiques are already thrown into a second Grand Tour in order to better support the bid of Valverde and Nairo. Enric Mas has shown already that he's pretty ambitious. Stephen Kruijswijk, he said that he would rather finish in the last position of the GC that go unnoticed, and he hasn't gone unnoticed, of course, but I'm sure that expresses a bigger ambition than just holding to this top five. And Miguel Angel Lopez, he already has a podium on a Grand Tour this year, so I don't think it would be.
So they all fancy you risk losing that position that you've got, and those positions are valuable. They're worth lots of points to teams and bigger contracts for riders. So it's a difficult one to. But I think you're right. I think the ambition that I sort of sense from Astana and Lopez is still there. I mean, I think, and he has, as we said, probably got the strongest team in the race. So if anyone's sitting in their hotel hatching a plan, it may well be Astana.
Yeah, yes, because they have the strongest strongest team by far. From the points angle, I would say that none of the contenders for victory should have that in mind, because Lionel Jumbo, Movistar team, Mitchelton Scott, or Movistar team, they already have a good haul of points, and that shouldn't be a problem for them to qualify within the 15 first teams in the World Tour at the end of 2019.
But it's more individual points as well that add value to a rider's worth, don't they?
They do, but I don't know until which point does came into account when a rider is making up his mind on his tactics for the upcoming day of racing? After all, this is quite a short-term sport, and when you are on the bike, heart beating at maximum heart rate, it's hard to remember that if you give two extra pedal strokes, you might lose 10 points in the World Tour standings.
This is very true. This is very true. Well, another rider I spoke to this morning was Adam Yates, Simon Yates' brother, of course, twin brother. We've not seen a lot of him at the Vuelta, and I went and had a word with him this morning to find out what his role might be the next 2 days. How did it go yesterday? How do you feel yesterday? That was a good job you did on the final climb.
Yeah, it's feeling all right. It's a steep climb. Hard climb is always in the Basque Country. But yeah, it's feeling good, so I managed to keep standing at the front there until the very finish.
Have you been riding this Vuelta thinking of how important these stages are and how big a role you'll have?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the first 9 days, I was barely here. I was just at the back chilling. And then, when it's been a tough mountain stage, I've always been there or thereabouts until the very end, until he didn't need me anymore.
Just finally, Adam, you know, a few days now from Madrid, is Simon going to do it?
I hope so. you know, I got close to Enduro, and then we're close here again, so let's just hope we can keep going, doing what we're doing, and take that top step.
And then after the Vuelta for you, you've got the Worlds and Lombardy. I guess those are two races you'll be having in the back of your mind as well.
Yeah, pretty much. Worlds are first, tough course, really tough course. I've not done any recon yet, so I don't actually know the climbs, but what I've been told is it's going to be brutal. And yeah, looking forward to it.
That was Adam Yates. Said he'd just been chilling out for the first 9 days of the Vuelta. But, you know, he came out of the Tour de France pretty well, finished it very strongly, and he may well do so here at the Vuelta too. And he may be the man for the World Championships. You know, it's a steep climb up to the finish. I spoke to his sports director Matt White about that at the start. He wondered about the British team he thought isn't perhaps one of the strongest in the race, so that might be a handicap for both the Yates brothers. But there's the World Championships, and then there's Tour of Lombardy as well, which is another race that suit him. Another guy I spoke to at the finish, Fran, just because he's been one of the most prominent riders, he's even had a nomination for Pedlar de Charme, Dylan Toynes, the BMC rider who's been up there in so many breakaways and has gone very, very close, including second on the stage to Michael Woods. So here's what he said at the finish.
Unusual not to see you in the breakaway. You've been able to take it a little bit easier today.
A flat rolling stage like this is not my parkour to go in a breakaway, so I kept it a little bit easier.
How do you reflect? You've gone so close now on so many different stages. How do you reflect on all your efforts so far in this Vuelta?
Yeah, it's really sad. I only came close and couldn't win yet. So, but in the end, I need to be happy also with the shape I am in and with doing all these results.
And are you looking at the next two stages as more opportunities for you as well?
Yes, really hard stages. I don't know how it's gonna be, but I have to see how my legs are.
Yeah, how do you feel? I mean, you've put in so much to this Vuelta. How are you actually feeling now?
Yeah, yesterday pretty good still. So, but today a little bit tired, and I take it easy now.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
A little reminder there that we are releasing Kilometer Zero Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, which means that there's one more to go, and that will come out tomorrow morning, following on from the one on Wednesday about the BMC racing team. And on Monday, it was all about sponsorship and the sponsorship crisis facing some teams. Our final Kilometer Zero is on Andorra, Lionel's favourite subject. And Lionel makes an appearance in this podcast.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Lionel, I forgot to tell you, there will be one less reason to hate Andorra, as from January 1st next year, roaming data will be free of charge for European Union residents.
In Andorra?
In Andorra.
Let's not get on to the whole thorny business of European Union residency.
Oh, yeah,
maybe maybe Lionel will have his Irish passport by then, I don't know. But anyway, we'll return to that, I'm sure, Fran. So that's our final kilometer zero from the Vuelta a España, the final one of nine. Hope you've enjoyed them. Thanks to The Economist for supporting that series. A little reminder that we've got some, it won't just end on Sunday with our final Vuelta podcast. Next week we've got, well, we've got the cycling podcast Femina coming next week, the September episode of that. We have got a diary from the Tour of Britain being released for friends of the podcast. We've got a diary from Larry Warbass and Conor Dunn's No-Go Tour also being released. We've got a report from Francois Thomazeau from the Canadian races as well. We've got a lot of material, and we haven't, if I'm perfectly honest, we haven't actually decided how and when we're releasing all this. But if you don't want to miss anything, sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. And an extra incentive is that if you sign up during the Vuelta, you'll be put in a prize draw to win some great Rafa and Science and Sports stuff, some swag. And if you're already a friend of the podcast for 2018, you'll automatically be put in that draw as well. And we'll draw a winner or winners very, very soon, next week, I would think. So sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15. Fran.
Do you want to know something about Enric Mas?
Sure.
The other day, he questioned me about my Rafa jacket. You know? He was impressed. He asked me, like, oh, man, how much does that cost? It looks neat. So, yeah, I mean, as if you, any of you is thinking about entering this draw, I think it is worth it.
Want to look like Enric Mas, or want to look like Fran being admired by Enric Mas? Then become a friend of the Cycling Podcast. Fran, we should leave it there. Nice, easy day for us. We're staying here. The start is here tomorrow, and then we're up to Andorra. So we'll see you tomorrow.
It felt so short, Richard.
Quality, not quantity, Fran.
Yeah, definitely. See you tomorrow.